Hi everyone, my name is Shahavit Schwartz. I'm currently studying at Yeshivat Drisha, and this is part of Gefet, a joint project of Hadran and Yeshivat Drisha, in which we enter into some of the sugyot that we're learning in Daf Yomi, in with an eye toward Iyun or toward learning slightly further in depth. The sugya that we'll be learning today is emerges out of a few lines in Gemara on Bava Metzia Daf Lamed Daled, the Daf that we're doing now. But fundamentally, the question that we're going to be asking is a larger question that appears throughout Shas, the question of how do we define how do we define the moment of Gemar Din, which we can roughly translate to the legal point of no return, the point in legal proceedings at which the commitments that I make as one of the litigants, which the point at which I can no longer take back those commitments. We'll be discussing cases in which the litigants take on certain commitments or obligations that might go beyond what the black letter law demands of them, right? The verdict in a case might be that I get off the hook, but I might, for whatever reason or another, decide that, let's say, I'm a defendant that I want to pay what I'm being sued anyway. And the question is, when that happens, until what point in the legal proceedings can I change my mind, decide to say, actually, I didn't want to do that. I want to do what Meikar Hadin, what the court. So verdict would have been otherwise, would have otherwise demanded of me. And at what point do we say, no, you made a commitment, story's over, this is what we're going to do now. That's going to be the question that we're going to ask today, and we're going to see it emerge initially in our sugya on Bava Metzia. We're currently in the third parak of Bava Metzia, and a parak that deals with laws of shomrim, of guards, or people who are guarding others' objects. And just quick review for context purposes, right? There are different kinds of shomrim with different levels of responsibility for the objects that they're guarding over. And the sugya in particular that we're dealing with is talking about a shomer chinam. Now, a shomer chinam who guards who watches someone else's object for free has a fairly low level of responsibility, right? If the object something happens to the object due to his own negligence, then he's responsible to pay back the owners for it. But if something happens. If the object is kind of lost or stolen from him in a normal way, Meikar Hadin, the person, the Shomer does not have to pay and instead gets off the hook via a shvuah, an oath that they take in Beit Din, Shvuat HaShomrim, that in which they swear that they weren't negligent with the object and that they themselves weren't the one who stole it. Now, the sugya that we are dealing with is referring to a case in which a person, instead of choosing to take a shvuah, decides that he would rather just pay. But there are a couple of different reasons why someone might do that. One sort of the more obvious reason is that a shvuah, taking an oath in court, is a really big deal. If they take out a sefer Torah, you're taking the name of God. It might be that this object that you were watching isn't worth that much money. You don't want to enter into such a dangerous game, and you would choose just to pay instead. There's another reason why a shomer chinam might do that, and this will become a little bit relevant later, which is that. One of the cases in which a Shomer Chinam takes an oath is a case in which an object was stolen from him. Right. So what happens if I take the oath, get off the hook, and then 2 weeks later we find the thief? Right. So a thief, according to Halakha, has to pay not only the value of the object that he stole, but also a fine of kefil, double the value of the object, essentially. And in a case in which he stole from a Shomer, but that Shomer took an oath, he pays back the kefil to the original owner of the object. Okay, but what if the Shomer Chinam, instead of taking that oath, chose to pay the owner the value of the object that had been stolen from him? What if I am a Shomer Chinam, I choose to pay instead of taking an oath, and then a week later we find a thief? In that case, the thief pays the kefil not to the original owner, but to me, the Shomer, because I've sort of purchased, it's as if I've purchased the object via my payment to the owner, to the object's owner. In that case, the thief pays not the owner, but me. And so it actually might be that if an object is stolen from me and I think that the police are going to do their job, they're going to find the thief, it might pay for me instead of taking an oath to just pay for the object. And then ultimately, in the end, I might serve to benefit financially. So that's the background that we're working with, right? There are several reasons why a Shomer HaChinam might choose, instead of taking an oath, to pay. But now the Gemara is going to ask, what if the Shomer HaChinam changes his mind? So Gemara begins, Pshita, Amar Eini Meshalem, the Chazar v'Amar Har Eini Meshalem, right? So in a case in which I at first say, don't want to pay, I'll take the Shavua, I'll take the oath, and then I change my mind and say, actually, I'm ready to pay. Haka Amar Har Eini Meshalem, great, you committed to pay, all's well. Ella Amar Har Eini Meshalem, the Chazar v'Amar Eini Meshalem, my. Right? But if I started out by saying, yeah, sure, I'll pay. And then after that, go back on my word and say, no, I want to do what the black letter law requires of me, take the oath and get off the hook for payment. In that case, what is the deen? Now, the Gemara breaks down, analyzes this question in the following terms. Mi amrinan, do we say mehadar kahadar bay? Right. Do we say that what's going on is he is actually retracting, recanting his initial commitment to pay? Or maybe he actually really still means the thing he originally said, which is that he's willing to pay. And he's just trying to push things off, just trying to make the court proceedings take longer. Maybe he's trying to get the money together. He really still intends to pay, and he's just playing around. So that's the way that the Gemara reads this question. And Rabbeinu Tam, in Tosfot on the sugya, learns from this Shach Levataria and the sugya here a broader, more fundamental principle in the question of right about the question of when is Gemar Din, when is that legal point of no return. So Tosfot reads the question at the end of our Gemara. Did he really mean to recant, or is he just playing around, as a solid evidence that if he really meant to take back what he had committed to, then he could, right? We're trying to discern his intent so that we can discern what the deen should be. If he really meant to go back on it, we let him go back on it. All he did was commit to pay. He hasn't actually paid. So Tosfos will learn from this, or Rabbeinu Tam learns from this, a more fundamental principle that Gemar Din does not take place, right? The legal point of no return does not happen until the point in which the payment has actually been executed. Up until then, he can go back on it. Now, we're going to look at this Tosfot and see how Tosfot learns, right, this broader principle and how he reads that into a number of other sugyot in Shas. Mikan mochiach Rabbeinu Tam, that from here Rabbeinu Tam proves, de'ima amar l'chaveiro hushava v'tol, kodem she'yishava yachol lachzor v'lomar shava v'lo ashalim. Right? Tosfot extrapolates from our sugya to a different kind of case, a case in which I, a person who is a defendant, right? I'm being sued. If I say, even if there isn't sufficient evidence against me, that if you, the plaintiff, will take an oath, I'm ready to pay, right? I'm getting sued. I don't want to pay, but let's say I, for whatever reason, I commit that, like, if you're willing to take an oath that I owe you money, then sure, I'll pay you. That's a commitment that I'm able to make in court. But Rabbeinu Tam says that we learn from our sugya that I'm able to lachzorbi, I'm able to recant or renege up until the point in which that shvuah has, in which the plaintiff or the other party has taken the shvuah. Now Tosfot takes this principle and with this principle reads a number of other sugyot in Shas, one of which is a sugya in Bava Batra that refers to a case just like I just, a case that is similar to one that I just described, right? A case in Perek Yeshno Halin about an accusation, right? There are two litigants. One accuses the other of stealing his slave, right? And then the other party, the defendant, says, "Vahala actually, no, you sold this person to me, and therefore I'm not liable to pay back his value or to return him to you." Right. So theoretically, meikar hadin, fundamentally, the plaintiff here doesn't have enough evidence, right? The claim of mechartoli, right? The claim of no, this was actually was a legal transaction is enough. Theoretically, he's off the hook. Maybe he would have to take a derabanan shvuah, but that's a different question, right? On a fundamental level, there isn't enough evidence against him. But if he says right, the defendant says, if you are ready to swear that I stole this slave from you and that I must return him, then I'm willing to give it back. So in that case, right, in that case, what's the deen? So there's a machloket girsaot, a question of what the right version of the text is, but the version of the text that Rabbeinu Tam reads here is right, v'nishba eino yachol lachzorba. If he commits to say, if you want to take a shvuah, then I'll pay you, and the plaintiff takes the shvuah, then the defendant cannot, at that point, lachzorbo, cannot recant, cannot change his mind, right? The defendant is able to change his mind up until the point in which the plaintiff has actually taken the shvuah, right? He said, and the plaintiff has mishbah. At that point, the defendant can't take it back. So, right, Rabbeinu Tam here notes that there is a machloket girsaot, right? He says, lo garas nishba belova, right? We saw the word vinishba, and if he's sworn, at that point, you can't take it back, right? We have it with the vav, not without the vav, because without the vav, it would sound like, right, ritzon chai shava betol, nishba veino yachol lachzorbo, right? If you want to take it, if you want to take an oath and I'll pay you, then he can take the oath, and I can't, and I, the defendant, can't take it back. Right. If it didn't have a vav, it would make it sound like the court and the plaintiff can decide to take the oath even against the new wishes of the defendant. Rabbeinu Tam says, no, there is a vav, vinishba. He must have already taken the oath in order to get to a place where the defendant can't take it back anymore. Rabbeinu Tam brings another sugya that also relevant to this question, a sugya in the beginning of Shvuat HaDayanim, the parak in Shvuot about Shvuat Modeh Mitzah, right? If someone sues me for $100 and I say, no, actually, I only owe you 50, in that case, min haTorah, I pay back the 50 that I agreed that I owe you, and I take a shvua on the other 50, that I don't owe you that other 50. But for some of the reasons we mentioned earlier, I might not want to take that shvua. I might say, actually, I prefer to pay you and not take that oath. So in that case, what does the sugya in Perek Shvuat HaDayanim say? Imamar eni nishba, right? If the defendant says, I don't want to take the oath, and instead I actually want to pay, putrino tomiyad. We get him out of there, meaning get him out of court quickly or immediately. Right, what's that about? Right, the minute that I agree to, instead of taking an oath, pay, we want me out of here. Now, why is that? So Tosfot says, lo kedepiresh Rashi. Right, it's not like Rashi says sheputrino to lefi she'eino yachol lachzorbo, that we get him out of there because he has no way of recanting or reneging anymore. Right, because he's already reached gemar din, the point of no return. But so what emerges in Tosfot is an opposing shita in Rashi. Right, Rashi thinks what? That from the moment that a person has committed, has declared his intention to pay rather than swear, that's it, that's the margin, and that's the point of no return, he can't take it back. Tosfos says, no, as opposed to that, that's not why we take him out of court. We take him out of court dafka because he could take it back if he wanted to, right? We kick him out because he could come back and say, actually, I want to take the oath and I don't want to pay you, but we get him out of there so that he'll feel awkward about coming back in. All right, so what emerges here, Tosfot's read of three different sugyot. Rabbeinu Tam's shita, voluntary obligation, really only takes effect once the verdict has been carried out. Once, if I said, sure, take a shvua, once you've taken the shvua, if I've said, sure, I'll pay, once I've actually paid, right? He reads the sugya in Bava Metzia about a shomer chinam, right, who wants to pay rather than take an oath, as the Gemara is asking, does he want to go back? Because he could go back. Does he want to renege? Because he could renege if he chose to. The sugya in Bava Batra about a defendant against whom there is not sufficient evidence, right? If he says, Ritzoncha hishava v'tol, sure, take an oath and then I'll pay you, vinishba, and the guy's taken an oath, then the defendant no longer has the opportunity to renege. All right, that girsa allows for Shitar Rabbeinu Tam that the ability, he loses the ability to recant only once the actual legal action has been carried out, only once the plaintiff has taken the oath. And in Shavuot, right, we have this machloket Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, right? The way Rashi is presented here is we get him out of court immediately so that because there's no reason to leave him there. He has nothing else to do in court. He can no longer recant. Whereas Rabbeinu Tam is saying, no, we get him out of court so that he doesn't recant. He could recant, and that's why we want to get him far away from us so that he doesn't change his mind. All right. That being said, Rabbeinu Tam, and this is quite apropos for a sugya about when a litigant can change their mind, Rabbeinu Tam, it seems, actually changes his mind. And we have an additional shita of Rabbeinu Tam that is quoted in Tosfot that emerges from a tshuva of Rabbeinu Tam, in which Rabbeinu Tam actually says the exact opposite, says something much more similar to what seems like what Rabbeinu Tam said b'shem Rashi just now, which is that Voluntary obligation takes legal effect from the moment that I've made a sincere good faith commitment in court to the thing that to the thing that I am committing to, right? So if I say, no, I'm not going to take a shvua, instead I'm committing to pay, from that moment, can't take it back. Actually, when you read that sugya in Bava Batra that we saw about the fight about the whether the slave was stolen or sold, right? If I, the defendant, say, if you want to take a shvua, then sure I'll pay you. In that case, yishava ve'eno yachol lachzorva, right? The plaintiff can take a shvua even against the will of the defendant, meaning even if the defendant changes his mind, him changing his mind no longer has any legal relevance. He made a commitment. He has to stick to the commitment. Tosfot now brings in another sugya from Sanhedrin in order to explain and elucidate this further. Hadamrinan v'perek zeborer, gabe ne'eman alai abba v'avicha, right? It's a case about two litigants who are agreeing to judges who might under other circumstances not be considered kosher judges. There, the machloket lachar gmar din, aval kodem gmar din, divrei kol yachol lachzorbo, right? The machloket about whether or not they can retract is only after gmar din. Okay, so right, only after this legal point of no return. So what exactly do we mean by the legal point of no return? So what Tosfot says, hacha afilu kodem shenishba ino yachol lachzorbo, right? Rabbeinu Tam's new shita, even before the oath took place, He can't recant. Why not? Right. The idea of gmar din, right? This legal, the end of the legal proceedings, right? What? How do we define the end of the legal proceedings? Not when the shvua itself has taken place, not when the person has actually taken the oath, but we define it by the commitment on the part of the defendant, right? When the defendant says, I'm willing to pay you on the condition that you take a shvua, that commitment is in of itself considered gmar din. That is considered the end of the legal proceedings. It's considered the legal point of no return. Now, what's Tosfot going to do? What is this shita of Rabbeinu Tam going to do with our sugya, right? When we saw the question of the shomer chinam, right, we were wondering, did he actually mean to recant or did he not mean to recant? Sounds like if he actually meant to recant, we would let him. So what is Rabbeinu Tam going to do with that case? Right, the fact that we're trying to discern whether he intended to recant doesn't mean that he actually could recant if he wanted to. Ella rutsehu lachzor. Rather, we're just trying to figure out whether he wanted to recant. Right, this is it's turning into more of a psychological game than a question of whether or not he actually could recant. What we want to figure out is not whether he will recant, but whether he thought he could or intended to. Now, why does that matter? It matters because of what we said earlier about why the Shomer Chinam would choose to pay rather than take a shvua. Right? We saw that one of the reasons it could actually be financially beneficial to the Shomer to pay rather than swear is because ultimately he would get the fine. If we found the thief, he would get the double payment from the thief. Tosfot saying, but if he intended to lachzor, he forfeits his right. If he intended to recant, he forfeits his right to the double payment from the thief. Ela shorotzeu lachzor, afa bishenu yachol, v'lo mikne lekfela, mishum da'atar chedavetin, k'dam rabsamuch gabe hahu da'af kibkifei, right? If he really did genuinely intend to recant, because he was messing around in Beit Din, because he was messing around in court or troubling the court, he forfeits his right to the kepa from the thief. So when we say that we want to figure out whether he intended to recant, you don't have to read too much into it. You don't have to read from that he could recant. It just means that we care about figuring out what his state of mind was. So he names another example of a case in which, we see the term mehadar kahadar bay as not meaning that a person actually could recant necessarily, just that we're reading into his intentions, and a case in which we want to figure out whether he wanted to take things back, even in a case in which he couldn't. So this is right. Shitat Rabbeinu Tam across the board Right, we saw the earlier version of Shaddai Rabbeinu Tam. Nothing is really final until the moment when the legal action is carried out. But here, Rabbeinu Tam has changed his mind and has said that no, actually, voluntary obligation takes effect from the moment that I have made a commitment in court. Presumably, there are some requirements that it happened in a judicial context that we know that it's a good faith commitment. But given that the commitment takes effect, I can't take it back from the moment I commit to something, not even before the legal action itself is carried out. Just to review quickly. Right, we have early and late Rabbeinu Tam and the readings of each of the three sugyot that we've seen. So the sugyot of Metzia about the Shomer Chinam, who chooses to pay rather than take an oath. Right, the first Rabbeinu Tam Kama. Right, the first shita of Rabbeinu Tam is that we want to figure out whether he intended to recant, because if he did intend to recant, we let him recant. That's right. That's the pshat reading of the sugyot. Later, Rabbeinu Tam says no. We're just trying to figure out his state of mind. That has ramifications for whether he forfeits his right to the kefel, but it doesn't actually mean that even if he wanted to recant, he could, because he made a commitment. Once he made the commitment, no takebacks. So again, Bava Kama. This is where the machloket girsaot comes into effect, right? The machloket about what the correct version of the text is, right? A defendant against whom there's insufficient evidence, right? But I say, plaintiff, if you're willing to tishavah v'tol, right, then the question is it the case that in only when I've made that commitment, v'nishba, and the plaintiff is taking the oath, then eino yachol lachzorba, then the defendant can't take it back? Or is it the case that from the moment I've made that commitment, then the plaintiff is able to nishba, v'eino yachol lachzorba? The plaintiff is able to take an oath, and the defendant is unable to take it back. Right, that's the machloket girsaot, right? Fit the different girsaot fit with the different reads of early and late Rabbeinu Tam. Now the sugya in Shavuot, again, why is it the case that once I say I will pay and don't want to take a Shavuot, we get him out of the room? Is it because, like Rabbeinu Tam, like early Rabbeinu Tam says, we get him out of there because he could renege, he could recant, and we don't want him to, so we make the situation such that it won't feel good for him to do so? Or later Rabbeinu Tam can read that sugya the way that Rashi did. We get him out of there because he's got nothing left to do. No takebacks, has no opportunity to renege. Why would he stick around? Now, we saw a number, right? We saw in Bava Metzia that Tosfot quoted Rashi as having said something similar to the Shita of later Rabbeinu Tam, which is to say, right, we kick him out of the room because once he's made the commitment, there are no takebacks and he's got nothing left to do. The matter is still open as to whether or not that is in fact what Rashi thought. Right, we see in Tosfot and Bava Metzia, right, Loki Depirish Rashi Shiputrino Telefisha Eno Yachol Achzorbo, right? We get him out of there because he has no way of changing his mind and his right has no way of changing his mind. But Tosfot in Shavuot, the sugya in Shavuot HaDayanim, in which that case actually shows up, has a gentler reading of Rashi there that actually gives us maybe a slightly different perspective, right? Instead of saying that the commitment itself obligates, Tosfot in Shavuot quotes Rashi as saying, Pirish HaKontris, Shelo Yachzor Bo Kodem Sheyetze Mi Beitin, that he, right, we get him out of there so that he won't recant before leaving Beitin, right? That makes it sound like the thing that gives finality to his commitment isn't the commitment itself, but maybe it's actually physically leaving the Beit Din. Maybe there's a moment, maybe the physical boundary, right? Maybe that renders the judgment final. There's something that it's still not quite that the judgment has been executed, that the legal action has taken effect, but it's a sort of gentler read. And if you look at Rashi himself in Shavuot, it's not totally clear what he says, right? What is Rashi, or whether he fits into either of these reads? Right, what Rashi there says, right, ain't putrino tomiad, we get him out of there. The ain mashinoto, Rashi says, ain mashinoto kan shelo yachzorba. Right, we don't leave him there that shelo yachzorba, that so that he won't recant. That in some ways actually sounds closer to the first opinion of Rabbeinu Tam, right? And then Rashi says, but al kor chacham shelo miyad shekibel alav bebeitin, right? But it still sounds like, okay, he has to pay even against his will because he's made a commitment, but on the other hand, we kick him out so that he doesn't recant. It's not totally clear what Rashi means, and I think it's worth noting whenever Tosfot quotes Rashi in order to be cholek, to go back and check what is it that Rashi actually meant to say, and whether or not that matches with the way that Tosfot read him. There is an additional sort of an additional shita in the Yad Ramah that fits in some ways quite well into Shitat Tosfot, Rabbeinu Tam Kama, meaning the first shita of Rabbeinu Tam, but in some ways actually gives it a little bit of a twist. And what the Yad Ramah says, right? If we remember, Rabbeinu Tam said that from the moment that the judgment itself has been executed or carried out, right? So if I made a commitment to pay, from the moment I paid, if I've made a commitment that I'll pay you as long as you take the oath, then you take the oath, right? That's enough, but you need at least that, right? My words itself, my commitment itself isn't enough. The Yad Ramah adds a little twist, right? He says what? Gmar din dahaha, and he's referring to the case of the fight about the slave, whether the slave was stolen or purchased. Gmar din dahaha mistaber de lo have el batar de ishtabat toveya ve amre le bedina le nitzba seiten lo inami chayava taliten. Right, the gmar din in that case, right, when I, the defendant, said, "Sure, plaintiff, take an oath, and then I'll pay you." Right, gmar din isn't right. It is not only once the plaintiff has taken the oath, but also once the Beit Din has said to the defendant, okay, you have to pay, say tainlo, or you are obligated to pay, chayava tali tainlo, that gmar din, hold on. Right, gmar din, the moment, the point of legal point of no return is doesn't even happen when in the moment when the legal action, the oath itself is carried out. Rather, it requires some kind of ratification on the part of the court or the Beit Din, right? I say, sure, if you swear, I'll pay you. So then the plaintiff swears, and then the Beit Din has to say, yes, and now you must pay. That's the moment at which point the defendant can no longer take it back. It's not enough even when the oath has already been taken. At that point, if the plaintiff took the oath, the defendant can actually say, never mind. So the Yad Ramah, he goes even further than the first shita of Rabbeinu Tam, not that much further, but requires a kind of ratification on the part of the court. Now, if we take a step back, I think we can think about the different shitot that emerge here as having something to say about more broadly how voluntary obligation works within a legal framework writ large, right? On the one hand, and this I think is true for the shitot of Rabbeinu, the first shita of Rabbeinu Tam, that it's the legal action itself that renders that gets us to Gmar Din, and of the shita of the Yad Ramah that you need some ratification on the part of the court, right? What we're talking about, even when it comes to voluntary obligations, we're talking about a legal framework. We're talking about a kind of formal structure and infrastructure that works according to rules and principles, and certain things have legal weight. What doesn't have legal weight? My saying stuff, right? The commitments and statements of a person, of a litigant who comes to court, don't necessarily mean anything. What means something? Legal action. We have ways of defining what constitutes legal action. Oaths constitute legal action. Payment constitutes legal action. If I'm the Yad Ramah, I might, even those kinds of things, in order to render them genuine legal action, we might need some kind of ratification on the part of the court itself. But right, according to those shitot, even these kind of voluntary obligations and commitments that go beyond the black letter law, even those commitments are still operating within the rules of the game, as it were, of the halachic legal framework itself. On the other hand, and I think this we see this more in the later shita of Rabbeinu Tam, and which perhaps we can understand in Rashi as well, is a way of seeing the halachic legal system as kind of as more of an extension of human beings who act as kind of autonomous private actors with authority and power over their own property and the ability to make agreements and come to conclusions together. And if we're thinking about the legal system in general as an extension of that, and certainly voluntary obligations that I take on within the legal system as really just an extension of my power as a private person to make commitments, and of course, yeah, my commitments should have weight and should even have legal weight. The very fact that I am willing to say, and we have a judicial framework that is willing to ensure that I'm making those commitments in good faith and I mean them seriously, the very fact of my making commitments is enough to obligate me. And as such, I'm not able to, I would not be able to recant or renege from the moment I have made a sincere good faith commitment. Even in that kind of case, we might still require certain conditions be met, right? To know that the commitment was made in good faith. We might need to leave Beit Din because ultimately, right, the shita, the possible shita of Rashi that I need to walk out of the room, and we might need to draw a line in the sand somewhere, and we might decide that the line in the sand is when I leave the room. But fundamentally, it's my commitments themselves that have power and have legal weight. So just to review the different shitot that emerge here and the different kind of ways of thinking about what really does affect or where the force of voluntary obligation in court comes from, right? There's the most stringent on the defendant, I guess, shita is that of the later shita of Rabbeinu Tam, maybe the shita of Rashi, that the commitment itself obligates, right? My saying I'm willing to pay or I'm willing to pay on the condition that you take an oath. My words have meaning, my words have weight. I said them in court, I meant it. That's enough, and I can't take it back. On of another version of that shita, which maybe emerges from Rashi, the idea that commitment itself obligates once we've, but we have to delineate it somehow. And it might be that the way that we delineate it is when I leave the room, right? When my commitment itself has ended in a kind of temporal formal way. At the end of the legal proceedings, when I walk out, that might be the point of no return. And then we can even go a step further and think like the early Shita of Rabbeinu Tam, that no, my words themselves don't necessarily obligate me in a way that I can't recant. I can go back on my words. My words in court are just words, words, words. It is legal action itself that gives credence and weight to the things that I say. And if I say, sure, if you take a shavua, I'll pay you, I can go back on it in so as long as you haven't taken the actual oath. Though once those legal actions have been carried out, that's what carries weight in court. And you can even go one step further and think like the shita of the Yad Rama, that even those actions need some kind of ratification on the part of the court in order to bear legal weight. Thanks so much, and see you next week.